Because I didn't check Ian being on the phone. Thank you for letting me know. God bless. I convene the meeting. We are exactly 15 minutes later than we normally, because we're always 2 minutes late. Okay. With that, can we please take attendance for the record?
Yes. Good morning, everyone. Today is Friday, November 17th. If I call your name, please let us know if you're here. Shelley Maloney.
Here.
Ivan Perrone.
Here.
Ian Thomas.
Here. By phone.
Dane Sheldon is out.
And our prayers for Dane. He's ill, I understand.
Yes.
Okay.
Henry Robinson.
Here.
And Mr. Ray Monteleone.
Our prayers for Ray Monteleone. He's always ill. Okay.
And we have the gentleman from PFM today, Richard Pengalli.
Is anybody else joining us by phone?
Nope.
Okay. And no one from the public is in the room. They couldn't find us if they wanted to, since we didn't know where we were meeting, but it's okay. I'm glad I called you, Ivan, because it was a surprise to me when they were blowing up balloons, and I'm in the middle of this meeting, and the people are asking, what are they blowing up balloons for? I thought you had a serious meeting at a school board, because I made him move the other meeting to 9 o'clock.
Yes.
Okay, so we have a quorum. There are no public. If they come in, we will break the meeting and have them introduce themselves, since we're still subject to the sunshine that's on here. And with that, I would like to entertain. Now, here's what's interesting now. Since this is informational only, is it or is it still a regular meeting?
Yes.
I think it's a regular meeting.
Okay. So it's not informational only. So then I would love to entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion? Being none, I'll call the question. All in favor, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Done. Thank you. Okay, and just to folks, if it was informational, we couldn't have approved the minutes because it's not a regular meeting then. It's like a workshop that the school board has. Same analogy. Okay. Old business. Why do they always call you old? I don't understand it. Can't we just call it financial business? I'm kidding. So we have our investment advisor, asset management, market update, and summary of the quarterly investment report.
Okay.
May I turn the microphone over to you, sir?
Okay. Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. So I will review the quarter and try and give some updated numbers. This year, like last year, you know, week by week, a lot of changes. So very important to kind of stay on top of what the latest and greatest is. You know, we're still on Fed watch and very focused on what the Fed is thinking about in terms of interest rates, because that what drives your area of the curve. Page 5 of the report leads off with looking at inflation, and you know, every meeting this has been a big focus. We just got a recent updated number for CPI, and we continue to see the same trend where the headline CPI number had ticked down to 3.2%, and the headline number was actually lower than the core number because energy costs have come down, which of course is a little bit of a surprise, especially what's going on in the Middle East. But I think I heard a number this morning that you know, the crude oil price is $9 a barrel lower now than it was on October 6th before. You know, before the attack.
What's causing the decrease?
You know, part of the run-up was probably concern around the Middle East conflict escalating, right? You know, which is what you would expect given the region where it's at. And that's still something that's a risk out there, right? That. You know, probably even more so than we saw around the, you know, Russia-Ukraine conflict, there seems to be more risk of this one escalating and going out of control. Although, if you look at the market, it's generally been kind of muted in its response and behaving as if it's expecting it to be contained. So you had a run-up in prices initially that's come down. Generally, more broadly, there's been a big increase in oil output in non-OPEC countries, right? So the U.S. is pumping, I think the last number I saw, it's, you know, eclipsed its prior record amount that it's putting out. You have Brazil producing more, and Guyana is coming online and producing more. So away from OPEC, you have more oil out there. You also had this sort of bump when China reopened coming out of its zero COVID policy. Well, you know, it's now opened back up and you're not expecting to see that bump again. And in fact, there's an expectation that China is going to be slowing down going into the next year here. So all of this seems to be, you know, weighing on oil prices.
Question, yeah. What about Iran? Does that Iran factor in?
Well, yeah, so that, you know, Iran's a big oil producer, right. Although I think I heard that China, I guess, buys a lot of the Iranian oil, mm-hmm. which, because of the sanctions, have actually helped China in buying it at a cheaper price, I think. But yes, if, you know, if through Hezbollah, which is, you know, one of their proxies, things escalate, then yeah, you probably would see a spike in kind of the oil prices again.
What's interesting is it is not a supply issue. It is totally a policy and political issues that are all going on. If we enforce and stop, control Iran's ability to sell oil, like there was at a point in time, that would impact what China could buy.
Right.
If we impact Putin selling to Germany and
right.
the others' ability to do it. So the whole policy and political thing, which I bring up at every meeting about oil because of my client base and my understanding of what's going on in the world, we are very much at the hands of man versus nature or God on this one that's taking place. And my fear is, because that's the case, I don't even hold, and that's why I was asking your opinion about why it's dropped, okay, and is dropping now. It always seems to be coincidental that certain things happen. So we had Election Day, and oil prices started to drop, okay? We're going to go through the winter now, and some people are predicting a severe winter, which means the need of fuel oil, not here, thank God, but elsewhere around the country, are going to go up. What's going to happen with the price? But oh my God, we're going to go into a presidential election year with that routine. Would the policy again and procedure come in? So we're pretty much at the whim of what's taking place. And I'm trying to figure out, and without luck, who are the major players? In other words, many years ago, most of you weren't even born, you and I were, okay, when they were controlling gold and silver and platinum, we knew there was a certain group specific in the country that were making a run and change the value of what was taking place. And I have been totally unsuccessful, unless you have some tidbits of information about who are the big players
yeah.
that are impacting the price. We hear about the price, but who is it? Who's setting it? I mean, it's not a cartel. I mean, there's all kinds of different people that's on there. And I'm not trying to be conspiracy theory. That's not my thought. I'm just trying to find out who's making the decision. Who decides what the price is when it goes out? I don't have a clue. And I am so frustrated that I can't find out. And this isn't a Google research project, okay? Do you have any idea on how we can find out?
Yeah, well, I mean, even before I've admitted that we don't really have expertise in the oil markets, but you're right. I mean, typically, you know, when we talk about demand is down or supply is up, you know, many industries, commodity industries, usually come back to kind of, you know, a small group or a couple different industries or something like that. So I'll ask around.
And I'd love, call me up. We can wait between
sure.
meetings.
Yeah.
I can still hear from you.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So
I do have a clarification question. You did mention, I think you mentioned that production in the U.S. was up.
Mm-hmm.
Was that because the strategic oil reserves, or this is actual output?
Yeah, so output is up. And this, I'll actually forward you guys the article I was reading yesterday on this. But so a lot of the manufacturers have actually become more efficient at pumping oil. And so that's helped them produce more. But the frackers, whatever the other right. traditional drillers, drilling, you know, out of the Gulf, there's less rigs, but they're actually more efficient at producing more oil. So.
But it seems kind of ironic that they'll produce more efficiently, which gets their price down.
Right.
So just think of the matrix, you know, how that intersects, that you may end up not making the best answer from a profitability standpoint. There's just so many of these econometric model situations that are driving me bananas, trying to figure this all out as to what's going on. That's why I fall back to, I think it's human being or human beings, plural, policies and activities and so on that are really impacting this, which makes it almost impossible to predict what's going to happen and when. I mean, Hezbollah could invade tomorrow, okay, and
one
so on.
Off the wall question. Are they getting subsidies from the feds or?
I don't know.
Yeah, you mean all oil companies?
Yes.
That I can tell you they're not. Okay, so.
It seems unlikely, but.
Yeah, that one I can tell you, I mean, they are
unless
not.
Unless they're turning the oil into an EV battery, then.
That's right.
You know, nowadays, you know, I don't know.
No, because I know the people I talk to, et cetera, you know, they're getting no help. Every single one of them, if you look at the proxies, not the proxies, yeah, the shareholders, think for upcoming shareholder meetings and this and that, etc. Every one of them, the illegal fees, the regulatory fees, everything is budgeted way up.
Oh, wow.
So it's where they were going down, now they're going up again on expenses.
You know, I don't know what to say. They say that we have so much, a limited amount of oil left, but somehow they find more oil. I just don't understand the whole concept.
Well, I was told that we have enough to cover us into the next century.
That's what I heard too.
And so on. We just got to be able to drill it, and we got to be able to deliver it.
So when is this spike down going to happen?
Hey, it's a presidential election in 2024. You know, everything is going to look rosy.
Oh, so the 25th? 2025 is going to go down.
Eggs are going to go back to 25 cents an egg.
In that case, that's conspiracy. That conspiracy is really true.
Yeah.
What we have lived through with COVID, when did you ever think toilet paper was going to be the big commodity? I happened to see the other night, I hate to say it, but I saw the other night, I hadn't seen this since COVID, okay? It's a joke short. A guy drives up in a black SUV, right? A guy walks up to him with a jacket, lifts his jacket up, and hands him what looks like cocaine, right? And he pays him in cash, and he drives off. The next big black SUV pulls up. Another guy comes out, looks around, and a roll of toilet paper. I had forgotten it, and I said, oh, my God. And nobody ever explained to me what the toilet paper had to do with COVID.
So. Morning.
Sorry for the levity. Go ahead.
No.
And it could run out of it.
Yes. page 6. Talk a little bit more about CPI and inflation measures. So, you know, I think in one of the prior meetings we talked about how the shelter component, the way it's measured, it tends to lag, and it's looking, you know, 6 months to a year in the past. And if you sort of swap out that measure, which, you know, still has that kind of high inflation from last year, or high rates in it and look at more contemporaneous measures, inflation actually looks like it's close to the Fed's target. So, you know, these numbers are as of August. The most recent readings had the shelter component down at 6.7, where you see 7.2 here, so it's continued to trend down. And then CPI, headline CPI, was at 3.2% the last reading. With the core inflation number at 4%. But if you look at the month over month change, the month over month number was 0.2, which, you know, on an annualized basis for the core number, again, is around the Fed target of in the range of 2%. So, you know, the trend continues to be in the right direction. We're just moving, you know, slowly to get down to the Fed target. Next slide, page 7. You know, this is something that we, you know, looked at quite a bit over the past couple years, is the idea that consumers still had a lot of funds that they had built up from not being able to spend it during the lockdown, stimulus-related payments, or, you know, kind of delayed funds. You know, we're now at the point where pretty much all of that has been exhausted, right? So we're starting to see the consumer, you know, level of debt service payments start to increase. They're starting to use more credit as they've, you know, now worked through all of those savings. In labor market, the unemployment rate last reading was 3.9%, so trending towards that 4.1% that the Fed is projecting we're going to see over the next year to 2 years, and showing a loosening in the labor market. The excess job openings has continued to come down. I think at one point there was in excess of 2 jobs for every unemployed person. That ratio now is 1.5 jobs. So, you know, at the outset of this, the Fed was saying that they thought they could achieve a soft landing by destroying a lot of these jobs that companies were demanding, as opposed to having people fired. So that, you know, we are seeing that that happen.
Are the different analysis that contradict? Because every time I hear about this jobless and all this other routine, they throw in the factors of people are not working anymore, they retired, they quit, they're only working part-time and all this other stuff. Again, it's mind-boggling to me. Mm-hmm. What do you guys use as the guideline that you have the most confidence in?
For how many people are out of work. I mean, our internal economists look at, you know, U3, which is the headline number, yeah. U6, which is the broader, you know, broader number, including the folks that you're talking about, people who are not actively looking for a job but are in those categories, and look at all of those numbers together. But you know, we also, and the Fed looks at that. It ultimately matters what the Fed is looking at. So yeah, I mean, those are the numbers that we look at. I think the wage rate is also very important, right? Because that means whether or not I can hire someone who is actively looking or who's on the sideline is going to play into how much I actually pay in wages. And so that number has also been trending down. In fact, I think that's the one that we show here. You want to have a balance between that wage growth rate and where inflation is. And so, you know, inflation has been exceeding that, you know, over the past, you know, year and a half. And now we're just kind of seeing that flip to the prior relationship, or we're trending in that direction.
And you know, part of this whole thing, the wage and so on, has to do with cost of living, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was on at a meeting with someone who owns, like, I don't know, 75,000 apartments,
okay,
you know, around the country, and this and that. They're out of Colorado, and they've got a lot of stuff here in Florida. And I'm asking them about, you know, what they're predicting this and that. And they believe, other than Florida, that the rents are coming down. Mm-hmm. Okay? But here, in South Florida at least, Tampa and Orlando, the places that I've seen most, I don't know about Tallahassee, okay? They're not. Mm-hmm. They're holding. Okay? And we see all this building going on here, see all these cranes, we see all these things. Those apartments are not full. And I'm wondering, how are the banks dealing with this? Okay, because I remember the 80s, the banks, sorry fellas, and started calling the loans and doing all this kind of stuff because they weren't meeting the occupancy. And the only difference I'm hearing now is that back then it was a condo collapse. They weren't selling the condos so the banks could pull the button because they weren't meeting the financing covenants that were necessary. But since these are rental and long-term financing mortgage routine, they don't have as many trigger capabilities. So if a person thought they would rent it in 12 months, okay, unless there's a cash receipt covenant, which most didn't have, it's on there, that they can't do anything about it. So they're running empty and these developers are going along with it, et cetera, and not lowering rents, because it's expensive as hell. I heard a one bedroom in Wolf Brickell is $3,600.
Yeah.
So a one bedroom is tough to have a roommate.
Yeah.
Unless you're married or have a significant other, right? So you can't split it. So that makes the teachers not being able, the nurses, the technicians in healthcare. I mean, that's what that was all about, that phone call. We had Governor Martinez and DeSantis on the phone, and I just flat out don't understand it. So I try to understand the reports and what you're doing.
Yeah, so are you saying that this person is saying that they have high rents here but they're not filling them, or are the rents high and they're filled?
They're not filling them, but not dropping them to meet demand, or the ability to pay was the phrase that was used. And elsewhere around the country, and I'm not talking about the blighted areas, the San Franciscos, right. The places where nobody wants to live anymore, mm-hmm. their rents are coming down. All right, it's on there. So I don't know. I don't understand. I absolutely don't understand. I know we've got a problem here with teachers and teachers' salaries and district employees' salaries. You know, where do they live? You know, they got to commute an hour and a half from Jupiter, which isn't cheap either, but so on. So I don't know. And when I look at these numbers, I just don't.
It's funny, and actually, as you're talking, I might invite one of our economists to one of our next calls.
That'd be great.
I think you guys would find it interesting. But whenever we come and do talks in Florida, we always have to bifurcate anything related to real estate, what's going on nationally versus here, because, you know, just as you said, since, you know, the pandemic, we've been the reverse of everywhere else, right? Everyone's moving here, everyone's growth rates are stagnating, whereas, you know, we're growing like gangbusters. Our housing retail markets or real estate markets operate in a different way than other areas. I don't have answers either.
If you could do that at the next meeting.
A lot of our numbers are national, and sometimes the local might be different.
And I think, and let's give them some insight. I think housing, food, okay, and transportation, which is oil, you know, gas prices, et cetera. If the economists can kind of speak to those three to us, because that helps us not just with our investment portfolio, it helps us as a district as it relates, because aren't we the largest employer here?
Yes.
If not, we're in the top three, right?
Yeah. In your housing situation, I thought some of that was related to maybe more than one family renting in an apartment.
That's what's going to happen.
I know sometimes when they buy houses, they have, you know, the same thing. So,
where they thought the interest rate hike was going to hamper the sell market, mm-hmm. in South Florida, some people have told me it hasn't hit it as bad because rents is so high. The alternative is pay the high interest rate, right, and lock into it and buy something. So buy a $350,000 house versus pay $2,800, $3,800 for a two-bedroom house or a three-bedroom house. This is crazy stuff, I tell you.
I agree. I don't know how people can afford it.
Some people are...
They moved to Orlando.
No, Orlando's getting bad.
Orlando is getting bad, actually.
I noticed in some neighborhoods, people are bringing mobile homes on their property, and people are living in mobile homes. Wow. You know, you have a house, you have enough land to bring a mobile home. I don't know if they're renting it or for a cheaper price or what. You know, some neighborhoods don't allow that, but I've seen.
Well, Dade County's experimenting on what they call the grandparents' home, where they're building one and two bedroom things because they have enough property, and they're giving them the zoning just to get the capacity to be able to get them homes. I know some of the healthcare, I think it's Baptist or somebody, is going to the dormitory method. They're buying apartments, taking the profit out of the rental piece so that their nurses and technicians can live, which is what I recommended to us here in Broward and so on. So it's, I think the school district should do it.
I think we're looking into that too.
Are you?
Yeah. Okay.
Good. I always enjoy it when you come at the time.
This is one of my most interesting meetings, for sure. So, you know, looking at general economic growth on page 9, you know, GDP, the last GDP reading came in at 4.9%, which was, you know, above what the expectations were, which was, I think, 3.3% for the number. Of course, driven by strong, you know, strong personal consumption. So the consumer continued to be strong, even though the projections for going into next year are probably more like overall GDP for 2024 being flat or maybe, you know.
Do they think part of that's going to be because credit cards may be hitting the cap?
Definitely increases in debt. Definitely. I mean, you're already seeing that trend now.
Yeah.
The SLOOS, or the Senior Loan Officer Survey, has also indicated increasing tightening of lending standards from the banks generally. So you sort of have the tightening standards, higher interest rates, depleted savings, more utilization of debt. You know, all of that should come into play next year, is the expectation. Next page 10, is the latest projections from the Fed. So they had increased from the prior quarter end, indicating that they expect that next year, by the end of next year, they'd only cut rates by half a percent. And that was a consensus view. So, you know, they've been communicating this idea of higher for longer. With these rates, which for you all is good for the portfolio.
So no increase the remainder of this year.
No increase for the remainder of this year.
And a potential decrease
next year.
Second quarter next year.
Next year, and that kind of is the consensus view. There's a wide range in what that view is. There's a wide range here, as you can see from what the Fed folks think. I think Goldman came out this week and said they think that by 2025 rates would drop to about 4.25% on Fed funds. Morgan Stanley thinks it'll be more like 2.25% to 2.5%.
Really?
Over that time period. Mm-hmm. So big difference in outlook.
And that's decrease or what it'll be at?
What it will be at.
Yes. Seriously? Back to 2 and change?
Yeah. Right, which is, I mean, that's the long-term, the Fed's long-term expectation is also that it'd be sub 2%.
So I'm just sitting there saying, if they really think, if that really could happen, should we be releasing and getting more debt and selling more bonds now?
I'm not sure.
I don't know the answer, that's why I'm asking the question. It's the flip side of what you're doing for us. It's the other side, the old PFM.
We don't have any capacity, right?
No, we do have some capacity. That's a more of a political internal issue. We do have capacity, and we certainly do have need to issue debt.
So why don't you communicate with our other PFM advisors about what their feeling is on it, that then maybe that's something we bring up to the school board about saying, hey, well, maybe.
I think we're finishing down what we issue with the general obligation bonds, yeah. The $800 million, which I think is due to be completed next year, FY25. So I think once that is done, I think we'll start talking about what the next step is on issuing debt.
So you don't think there's any logic, if the prognosis is for a significant drop, to not accelerate that?
Again, this is more of a, I think there's a need, of course, but with all things with the public, and there was a lot of negative how we...
No, I understand all that, but I'm just saying, would it be proper for us to, at least as a committee, suggest to you to communicate this is something that should be evaluated and looked at, and maybe we benefit for the district if in fact the rates are going to drop while they're higher to issue the debt? We don't have to answer it. We don't have to do it. They might give you, I apologize, it may give you more work and analysis to be able to go through. But I think that's what behooves this committee was supposed to do. That's that other hat.
Well, I'll add, and I don't want to speak for my other colleagues, but you presumably borrow debt at the longer part of the curve, as opposed, this is overnight rates that this
right.
is talking
yeah,
about.
Term.
And the longer term rates right. will typically anticipate views of the path of that already. So that will already be baked into kind of that longer term number, which is why the curve is inverted now. Right, so the 10-year rate is at 4.5%. So the expectation is, over the next couple of years, this decrease in the overnight rate is kind of baked into that. So all that's to say, you could get to the end of 2025, and there's no change in the 10-year rate over that time period, or it could be higher. That could be baked into that. The dynamics of the longer term rate are very different than the dynamics of shorter term.
So all I'm sitting there saying is, some kind of prognosis from them, what they think it is, etc., and then let the school board deal with the politics of the issue, but at least from the economics and from the financial, so on. If we were a private company, we're saying, and we're the treasurer, okay, that's what we should be evaluating right now because of the volatility of what's taking place. Because I know if I was CEO of a public company and my treasurer wasn't doing it right now with what's going on, I'd be sitting there saying, whoa. So, just a thought.
The near term, I think the outlook is good, right? So we really enjoyed these 5%, interest rates. So that's likely to what we're, going to see over the next year. But compared to a year ago, the bias is down from here as opposed to up. And we've talked about, and we've been, looking at sort of the timing around, putting more funds out longer versus, shorter. So.
I have a question. With the Inflation Reduction Act and infrastructure and American Rescue Plan, how is all that still affecting the economy? Is it, or has no impact?
The Inflation Reduction Act. spend
that,
a bunch
that
of
is
money.
A laugh act.
Right.
That
how
is
you,
an act
how do you spend
to laugh
money
about.
To reduce inflation,
the
right?
Inflation yeah. Reduction Act that had no impact on inflation.
Yeah. I think we saw the impact of all this stimulus money, which I think is what you're asking, right? And these acts over the past number of years, right? Past year and a half or so. So, if you're increasing spending, and increasing the debt, that's driving inflation and putting an upward pressure on rates.
Right, and I know that would be the impact, all that money funneling through cause all that, but so all that kind of trickled down, and now it's kind of complete, or is still being affected? I mean, I don't know.
That's a good question. I don't know how to assess the impact. I mean, I think when they were doing it, some of the numbers were over 10 years and,
right,
you know, 5 years, whatever. So I don't know the specific, you know.
At the corporate level, the ERC was going to be infusing Mega Millions back into the economy. Right. That's where you took a credit and you amended your 941s and got refunds for those quarters that were covered in there, which is that loophole they didn't close when they passed some of the acts. Mm-hmm. So you still see, now you see it on TV. Let me get you $87,000 and do all this stuff that's on there. But the IRS has put a clamp on that right now, and they're re-looking at what's taking place because mm-hmm. they're finding a lot of fraud. That's the only program I know left that would have direct new input of capital. So I think that's going to come down to a fizzle. And all the other stuff, I think, we've already paid the price. That's on there.
Yeah, again, I don't know. I'll look into it. But like I said, I know some of the spending, you know, was over time. So,
correct.
You know, when you're talking about the infrastructure program. So.
On the infrastructure, they've allotted it, but a lot of it hasn't actually been spent.
Been spent, right, right.
You can't tell in South Florida because there's cranes all over the place,
right,
and construction every place you go.
Right.
Every highway, every road, every tunnel.
But I see construction outside Florida too.
Excuse me?
Outside Florida, I see construction.
I was in Nashville the other day, last week. Same thing, I agree.
Yep.
But then I was also in Atlanta, not as much. And then and my buddies up in the Northeast, all those, the New Yorks, the Washington, they're having a problem.
I went to Utah, they had construction there too. I said, well,
Utah.
Yeah.
States that are growing and states that are doing economically well. I mean, we're in a cocoon here in Florida. And I don't go to places normally anymore that are not in the cocoon. So I'm spoiled.
Well, you live in paradise. Well, why would you go anywhere else?
No, they just don't let me in.
Well, on page 12, we touched on, the yield curve, which is inverted. The 10-year had run up to 5%, but has come back down. Kind of moving into spread product and looking at, you know, treasuries versus investment grade corporates, etc. We did see a little bit of widening in sectors other than treasury sectors over the course of the quarter to offset a little bit of the yield advantage in those sectors. Page 15 kind of shows the sector returns. So it was a good, generally a good quarter, without big, rate moves sort of from beginning to end. The overall quarter benefited from the higher yield levels. So you see that reflected.
How does the triple B, mm-hmm. how does a company stay in the triple B category, but they're doing real well? I've never been able to figure that out.
Well, a company may not necessarily want to, you know, improve its credit rating, right? If it's using a lot of debt because it's growing, right? So you usually see, companies that growing, in these lower credit tiers. And generally, post-financial crisis, a lot of your AA sector pretty much moved into the single-A sector. So the single-A corporates is kind of where most companies are at right now. Not unusual. Now, when they get on watch and potentially have, split ratings in the category and get close to being non-investment grade, then they're kind of concerned. But
we don't have anything at that level, right?
in our portfolio?
You may have some of the financial companies, which are big users of credit as a function of their business, might have a triple B rating. So
got it.
I'll check.
But we don't have any splits, like you were saying.
We don't have anything that would be a concern for moving out of investment grade. You guys are AA and above, I believe, in your policy. I know one of the things that we've recommended is actually moving to the A category. So yeah, you don't have anything that's in that category.
And we get a higher yield by moving into the A category, which is why you want us to contemplate
that. And we can diversify more if we do that. So
diversify by industry.
Yes.
Yeah. What do we have to do that? We have to
amend the investment policy.
So we do that, but that still has to be approved by the board, right?
Correct. Then I go through that.
So what we can do is recommend. So if we wanted to do that, what's our timing?
Well, there's a schedule that is in place. I think it's next year or in 25. I have to check.
Again, I'm just sitting here talking about timing. I'm maximizing our position. That's like when you think of today's meeting, you say, well, Ray was at it again. He's bringing up the thing. But this whole timing thing to me is real important. And that one, you know, they're suggesting it to us. Should we do it? And if we do it, should we do it sooner as opposed to later and benefit from the transition? Did I say it right? That's what I was trying to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've been an advocate for that for a while. Right. So it, whenever you do it, you think it's a good long-term decision. So.
Well, currently, right now, there's a schedule of all the policies that when they're going to be brought up to the board to be updated. And that's what we're following.
But that schedule set by who? I thought it was set by us.
By the district.
Yeah, but I thought that was based on recommendations of what this committee suggested the timing.
We can try to see if we can, you know, bump it up.
That's what I'm saying.
And see,
is it something we should consider as a committee?
Okay.
Like I said, they don't have to take our advice,
right,
but we can recommend it.
Right. So page 26. Just shows a snapshot of the portfolio at 9/30, and that bottom left chart shows the credit ratings in the portfolio. You see everything is AA or better. That one, the portion that non-rated usually means that it's a security that doesn't carry an S&P rating. This is just an S&P chart. But yeah, the yield at cost on the portfolio is moved up to 282 at 9/30, and you know, as we're buying more and more securities in the current market and rebalancing, that that yield level continues to go up. Jump to page 32. That shows the returns for the quarter. Portfolio had a return of 0.82%, outperforming the benchmark, which was at 0.74%, a good performance relative to the benchmark. And it was 279 versus 249 on the benchmark for the year.
Who physically decides on the companies? Back to that other page. Is it a committee you have?
Yes. So there's a.
Do you sit on that committee?
I don't sit on the committee.
Okay.
No, the committee has our CIO. It has a number of our portfolio managers. It has our chief credit officer.
How often do they meet to discuss our portfolio?
So the portfolio management team meets on a daily basis.
Okay.
To review all of the portfolios. They do that at the end of the trading day. there's a the credit team reviews and determines who comes on or goes off of the list of approved issuers, and there's a set number of names, 150 names, and the PMs can only buy securities off of that list, or the companies that we actually track and the credit folks actually track. And then there's a separate fixed income committee that sets strategy, you know, whether or not we're at 90% of the benchmark, 95% of the benchmark, should we overweight the 3-year area?
So we have all policies.
Yes.
And you guys have your policies.
Yes.
And then the actual managers follow both sets of policies.
Exactly. So we like to say we don't have gunslingers sort of sitting there kind of trying to, you know, call the market, right? So everything is kind of thoughtful. And the committees all work, you know, most of our clients are governmental entities like you, so they have that kind of mindset and are very cautious in, you know, kind of how they set strategy or pick companies.
Do they, does the upper committee, do they evaluate the different school boards, for example, and funds and just evaluate that and try to analyze differences?
They don't look at things that way. They view the clients based on policies. So because your policy is, so Florida tends to have a more more leeway based on state guidelines than some other states. So you might have another state that says governmental entities can only buy treasuries, and the treasuries have to be less than a year, right? So that'd be at one extreme, like Maryland or something. And then Florida has more leeway. So then within Florida, your policy is only AA. You might have some other restrictions. So you will be fall into one category of a more conservative investor. The school district is not the most conservative bucket of investors that we have, right? But it's driven by your policy more than the fact that you're a school district. And then again, because all of our clients are governments, you know, we're, you know, headline risk and all that is a big deal. We know that you all have more scrutiny than, you know, if we work.
Do you do universities?
We do, yeah.
Colleges?
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm going to be the incoming chair of Broward College's foundation.
Okay.
And they lost 20% last year. I mean, that is a number larger than, and I sit on a lot of these.
Yeah.
And have. That
number,
to me, blew my mind. So when I take office, the first thing I'm looking at is reevaluate who's making the decisions.
Yeah. Do they do a lot of alternatives? Is that?
No. Yeah. I don't. But again, I wasn't on that committee.
Okay.
So, but now I'm going to be looking at it a hell of a lot closer.
Hmm. Sounds like it needs to be looked at.
You're the man.
We just had a change in president, and they're looking for a new one now, so it's going to be a very interesting period. And I don't know who the interim is. I mean, I know who she is, but I don't. It's not like I know you guys. I might shake them up. Or get thrown off again. You know, I always come with sneakers when I come to these meetings.
But don't shake them up too much.
So page, I'll jump to the 1 to 5 year portfolio, which is the longer one for now. Sorry, that's page 65. Sorry, say it louder. Page 65. Make sure Ian's in here.
Dale, did you get that?
Probably has us on mute.
Ian.
What?
Ian.
Oh, I said Dale, sorry. Ian, did you get that?
No, I didn't hear everything there, sir. Say that again.
What page? I said was, did you get what page you were on? We didn't know if we lost you. 65.
Okay.
The age I wish I was.
Uh-oh. You'll get there one of these days.
Yeah, I get that. If I go in reverse.
Benjamin Button.
Right. Benjamin Button. So, you know, this is a 1-5 benchmark, and, you know, as I mentioned, we are looking at restructuring both of these, combining them. So we'll be showing that going forward here. AA credit quality, and the returns, page 71. Similarly outperformed 0.39 versus 0.24 for the quarter on the benchmark, and 2.26 versus 2.14% for the year. As I say, I'll pause for questions, but we're chatting all the way throughout here, so.
We're messing up your script.
I'm good.
But at least we learn more from it.
Yes, yeah. And I have some follow-up. The other thing is I'll look to include one of our strategists or economists on one of the future calls here. We may have to beam them into the meeting.
There were two companies I had question about.
Okay.
I'm glad we're invested in them, okay? From a citizenry standpoint. But both the GM Financial and, more importantly, the John Deere.
Okay.
Is John Deere doing a resurrection because they were getting their ass kicked by all the foreign vendors on the heavy equipment, the tractors, the this, that, et cetera. And I've seen the John Deere now in our investment portfolio and so on when I was looking at it. And I again see it on page 75.
So we are in a ABS for John Deere and for GM as well, an asset-backed security, right? So this is
it's safe.
It's securitized, right?
Right.
By receivables. So.
So it's not as much as straight equity.
Right. Right. So we're not taking exposure to their long-term corporate, business prospects or whatever.
And they're two great companies, however. As I said, foreign have beat the tar out of them. Someone asked me the other day, and I couldn't answer it. Somebody walked up to you and said, "How much money does the school board have to invest?" I couldn't answer. Then this arrived, you know, when you sent out the package. Called the guy up and I said, "Oh, it's..." He goes, "Really?" Oh, yeah, yeah. "You want to know what's bonds? You want to know what's..." But really, this just doesn't stick. Doesn't stick. And as I looked at the faces now, I asked the question, doesn't stick with you guys either. I mean, once a quarter we get this, but...
It depends on, you know, what they meant about invest. Are they talking about the core portfolio or everything is invested?
Correct.
It's a good point.
Everything is invested. You only pull it out over the investment when you're going to spend it. You know?
Right.
So that can be, that answer can, a person asking that question, depends on what they, how deep they want to get into it.
It came up this last time because I was complaining about the 20% loss.
Okay.
And I said, we didn't experience anything like that at the school district. And I've been involved in that one now 8 years now, 7 years,
correct,
whatever, maybe longer. It's on there. And two other ones, Leadership Florida and Leadership Brown, you know, we haven't experienced anything like that through this crisis.
Right.
We had a great quizzing
trade.
Me, "Well, how big is it?" I said, "It's big." School board's big. It's big.
How big is the college?
Not that big. Not that big. The college is in its infancy of trying to really do fundraising. Mm-hmm. So I'd say 35 under 40 million.
Well, it doesn't matter what size the portfolio is, 20% loss is, well, we're shouldn't be occurring any size portfolio or proportionate portfolio. True. Unless it's a risky portfolio, you expect to have, you know, big swings that will cover that.
Yeah.
Did they have an investment policy?
I'm going to learn all about it now. I was shocked when I heard the number 20%. I said, you know, was that just this month? You know, or what happened? I'm on the audit committee. Right. So it showed up in the audit, and it showed up in the 990 that's on there. So I still don't believe it. I still want to see the numbers. And I just physically cannot believe it. And I shouldn't have even brought it up here. Make sure it's not in the minutes. A school is the most you can say. No, don't even say it. Any other questions?
No.
Another great job.
Thank you.
How did you come down by train again?
I came down by Brightline.
You did?
And had an hour and a half delay last night.
What are they charging now, round trip?
It's $79 each way for the normal, and then $150 for the premium.
So. And the premium, you get food?
I don't know. I haven't done the premium.
So okay.
Drinks. Okay.
Yes, drinks. You get drinks.
And then what do you Uber from the station over?
Yes, yes. Although because of the delay, there was a down power line, and FPNL wouldn't let the train go further. So the train was stuck outside of Boca, past the station. We had to go back to Boca, ended up Ubering from there down to Fort Lauderdale.
So you spent the night here last night?
Yeah. Yeah. But outside of that, I love the train. Glad they started that.
You know, we are adjourned. So I'll tell the story now.